This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. My name is Peter Sprigg. I'm a senior fellow for policy studies here at the Family Research Council in Washington.
My name is Chris Gasek, and I'm also a fellow research council, Family Research Council fellow and colleague of Peter Spriggs.
And we're filling in for Tony today, who is still down in Louisiana dealing with the aftermath of the massive flooding. And we're looking forward to talking in our second block this afternoon to someone from Samaritan's Purse who is overseeing their relief efforts down there in Louisiana. We invite your continued prayer for that situation. But we have a good show today with a variety of people. Yesterday we were a little heavy on the gender identity issues, but today we have a bigger variety. And we're going to open with an author here to talk about a new book. Her name is Mary Eberstadt, and she has written a book entitled It's Dangerous to Believe, Religious Freedom and Its Enemies. Mary, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me, Peter and Chris.
Well, I ordered your book, bought your book a few weeks ago after hearing you speak about it, and I've tried desperately this afternoon to finish reading it. I haven't quite finished it, but I'm about two-thirds of the way through.
I can attest to the fact that there's much pink underlining.
There's a lot of highlighting.
Highlighting, not underlining.
So, why don't you begin, though, as you begin the introduction of your book, tell us why you felt you needed to write this book.
Well, in the very beginning, a few years ago, I was following a number of cases in the United Kingdom that were making headline news there. There was the example of the British Airways employee who was ordered to take off her crucifix, for example, even though other kinds of religious expression were allowed in uniform. There was a delivery driver who was fired for leaving a cross in his delivery van. There were a number of cases like that involving religious liberty that looked alarming, but of course, on this side of the pond, we all thought, well, we have a First Amendment. That could never happen in America. Well, fast forward a little bit. 10 years after the New Atheism, there have been a pile-on of cases involving religious liberty. Some of them are national news. Many of them are not. Many of them are in the courts. For example, the Lance Corporal who was court-martialed for putting a Bible verse up near her desk and refusing to take it down. And my point is that this pile-up of anecdotes is no accident. There has been a sea change in the way that traditional Christianity is perceived in Western countries. And because of that sea change, people of faith are on the defensive in the United States as never before. So I wanted to dig deeper into that and to get at the cases, but also the deeper strata beneath them about what's changing in our civilization. Because if we are going to have a sea change on the issue of religious liberty, we should have an honest, open conversation about it first and not just let it happen in the courts and by stealth.
Well, you talk in the book about a lot of sort of cultural factors at work here, but of course we at Family Research Council are a public policy organization, and you do mention two sort of key events that have been within the last several years that are very revealing of this trend. One is the HHS mandate, the so-called contraceptive mandate under Obamacare, and the other is the Supreme Court's decision redefining marriage to include same-sex couples. Could you talk a little bit about the significance of those events?
Well, yes. I mean, basically, Christianity is on a collision course with a rival religion, which is the religion that has grown out of the sexual revolution. And these court cases, same-sex marriage, obscenity cases, all the cases involving the social issues, most of which have been lost from the point of view of social conservatism, are all representations of this wider struggle between the sexual revolution and traditional Christianity. And it is very important for people to understand what's at stake here. It isn't just that there are battles in the courts, important though those are. It's also that we need to battle for the hearts and minds of everybody out there, including secular people. Part of why I wrote the book was to challenge them to look at the record of what their activists are doing. Here's another example, and it's very important. You opened with mentioning Samaritan's Purse being on the front lines of what's happening in Louisiana, and of course it is. Christian charities are under attack across the country for refusing to bend the knee to the sexual revolution and what its activists want. So, for example, crisis pregnancy centers are sued just because they don't provide abortion services. This happens around the country. They've been shut down, many of them in California and other places. Now, if you step back and say, who would want to get in the middle between desperate people and charities that want to help them? The answer is secularist progressives. That's who wants to get in the middle. That's who sues the United States Catholic bishops, because the bishops and their resettlement efforts with desperate refugees also do not give abortion and contraception. So these are ideological struggles and battles that make it clear who's in the moral right here. Who's in the moral right are the people trying to help desperate people, and who's in the moral wrong are the secular activists who are trying to get in the way of all that. And seeing something like what's happening in Louisiana and realizing that there are people out there who want to drain resources from these charities just because they're Christian is something important to understand. It's a very big story, and I don't think it's been properly put out there yet, which is why I have a whole chapter in the book that's just about the attack on these charities.
Right. And you, at points in the book, you use some very strong language. You don't hesitate to use the term witch hunt and to actually make direct comparisons with historical events such as the Salem witch trials of 1692. Can you explain a little bit about the parallels that you see between what has happened at times in the past and what we see going on today?
Yes, sure. So in Salem, Massachusetts, hundreds of years ago, the witch hunts grew out of the efforts by Puritans to purify the ranks. No dissent was tolerated. If stray Baptists or Quakers wandered into the Puritan midst, they were typically hanged. And so the idea of religious liberty, as later conceived by Thomas Jefferson and others, obviously didn't exist. Well, my point is there's a great irony here, because the real descendants of the Puritans today are the secularist progressives who are treating people who disagree with them the way the Puritans did. Now, obviously, we're not talking about literally killing people, but we are talking about literally imprisoning them from time to time and otherwise penalizing them and ostracizing them. So we don't want to go back to the world before the First Amendment. We don't want to go back to a place where people can't agree to disagree. But we are there now, thanks to the ascendancy of secularist progressivism. And my point is we need to get back to a more civil, grown-up understanding that we can disagree about important things without trying to drive dissenters out of the public square, which is what secularist activists are trying to do.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you a question. I don't know if my way of thinking here will gel immediately with what you're saying, but one of the things that strikes me is how much the left, or what we call progressivism, has changed, let's say, from Woodrow Wilson and particularly, let's say, FDR and the New Deal to the present. If I think of the New Deal and liberalism at the time as sort of like a solar system, let's say, right? The sun is what would have been like economic issues, right? And labor and those kinds of, core issues of dealing with, maybe how things are produced in society, those kinds of core kind of economic values. But one of the things that you said was incredibly intriguing to me, which is to compare this with this new religion that's grown out of the sexual revolution. Because it seems to me if you talk about progressivism now and the Democratic Party now, the one area where you cannot – they will brook no disagreement is on – the sun of the new solar system is this sexual revolution. I was wondering, I mean, do you see this as like the centrality of progressivism now?
Yes, and it is what is different, for sure. Today's progressivism is very much unlike yesterday's. And in the book, I mention figures like Christopher Lash, Martin Luther King, to some extent, representing the progressive wing of theological thought. Those guys would never have been okay with the treatment of Christianity by so-called progressives today. So the progressive quasi-faith has indeed developed in such a way that it's anchored to the sexual revolution. People, in the book, I go through numerous examples of the equivalent of sacraments and saints and the whole quasi-religious apparatus of this thing. Let me give you a quick example. If you remember at the end of the Supreme Court term, when the Texas case was decided, effectively widening access to abortion in Texas, there was a celebration on the steps of the Supreme Court that was surreal. People were hugging and crying and dancing, and a big party developed. And all of this around a case involving something that progressives used to regard as a regrettable necessity, namely abortion. That has gone from being a regrettable necessity, as they see it, to the equivalent of a political sacrament. So you couldn't do better for a visual than, you know, just thinking about the zeal and the unreason that was captured by that party on the steps of the Supreme Court after the Texas case. It's just a very evocative sign, I think, that what Christianity is up against really is a rival faith, whether its adherents understand that or not.
Mary, we do only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you, I think one thing, you know, I've seen other books that sort of try to raise the alarm with Christians, but something that I think is distinctive about yours is that you are actually appealing to liberal people to live up to liberal values. Is that how you see what you see as the solution to this problem, the current problem?
It's the only solution, because unless we get the attention of those people, things will stay the way they are, and things don't have to. Whenever there's a collective outburst like this of unreason, it's up to the people on the side where it occurs to rein in their activists. And we've seen a little bit of that, and I get into that in the book. We need to see a lot more of it by the left, and we have to start by approaching them proactively with these kinds of arguments about who really owns the moral high ground here, who's really being tolerant and who isn't.
Well, great. Thank you very much. Mary Eberstadt, author of It's Dangerous to Believe, Religious Freedom and Its Enemies. Thank you for joining us on Washington Watch.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we'll be right back in about 3 minutes here on Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
On the first day of our tour of Israel, we will stand on the Mount of Olives and look out over the old city of Jerusalem. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. March 9 through 17, we'll be going to Israel, the Holy Land. This is 2017, of course. We'll be flying from New York City, JFK Airport, direct to Tel Aviv, and then we'll begin our 9-day tour of Israel, including Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Jericho, Tiberias, Nazareth, the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, and all the places you've read about since you were a child in the Bible. For more information on this tour, you can order a brochure by calling us at 800-FAMILIES, 800-FAMILIES, option 5. Also, you can visit the website twholyland.com.
with a ministry opportunity. Here's Steve Tiber.
8 Days of Hope 12 will be going to Black River, South Carolina. Last year in October, 25 inches of rain fell in the state, causing $22 billion of damage. And now you and I get a chance to go to South Carolina this fall and encourage people who feel like they've been forgotten. We have 70 homes out of the 250 homes that we're looking to work in that need brand new roofs. If you've ever done any roofing whatsoever, a couple roofs in your life, or maybe you've led a roofing crew or worked in construction, consider coming to 8 Days of Hope. We're looking for plumbers, carpenters, painters. Man, there's something for everybody. For more information, go to 8daysofhope.com. We hope to see you there.
Be the hands and feet of Jesus. Visit 8daysofhope.com. Please pray for this relief effort and for the families affected by this flood. And if you can't volunteer but would still like to help, donations are also needed. You can give and learn more at 8daysofhope.com.
This message is provided by Liberty HealthShare.
You can control your health care with Liberty HealthShare.
Liberty HealthShare gives you freedom from health insurance.
You can finally make the right decisions for you and your family.
It's not insurance, it's medical cost sharing.
You can affordably control the cost of your medical expenses.
It's a group of individuals sharing the cost of health care. This is based on shared values.
You are not alone.
With Liberty HealthShare, you're part of something bigger, a group of people who care for and support one another.
Join the movement of people who share in medical costs and change the way you pay for your health care forever.
It's easy. Visit healthsharefamily.org right now. healthsharefamily.org. Enroll today.
Liberty HealthShare.
Together, we're changing health care for good. Check out healthsharefamily.org. healthsharefamily.org. Not available in Pennsylvania.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm Peter Sprigg at Family Research Council in Washington, along with my colleague, Chris Gasek, who is...
I'm right here.
Is right
standing
here
standing by to talk about something that's very important with you.
Right. We shared with you yesterday about the flooding that's taken place in Louisiana and how that's had a direct impact on Tony Perkins, the host of this show and president of Family Research Council, whose own home was flooded and they had to evacuate it. And by boat, and are now living in a motorhome that was moved to higher ground. So we do invite you all to pray for Tony and his family and for everyone in that state of Louisiana who's been affected by this really devastating flooding. As we mentioned, I think, you know, the fact that it didn't have high winds or wasn't a named storm of some kind makes it has perhaps cost this storm some of the media attention nationally that it deserves to have. To talk about what's going on, we have with us someone who is there on the ground trying to help. He's with Samaritan's Purse. Samaritan's Purse, of course, the relief charity that is run by the Reverend Franklin Graham. And they are on the ground in Louisiana, in fact, working out of Tony's church. And so we are glad to welcome Todd Taylor, Assistant Manager of U.S. Disaster Relief for Samaritan's Purse. Todd, thank you for joining us today. You're on Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me.
Todd, are we just correct that you are in at Tony's church? That would be Greenwell Springs, Louisiana?
Yes, sir. I'm in one of the offices right now.
And you're about, what, 30 miles kind of like east, northeast or something like that of downtown Baton Rouge?
That's correct.
Okay, I just wanted to fix the location for everybody.
Just so people have a sense of, well, just give us an update. What's the situation that you found of the residents there when you arrived, and what's going on to try to help them?
Yes, Samaritan's Purse has responded not only to this area, but also to Lafayette with the catastrophic flooding. You know, we're set up here at Greenwell Springs Baptist Church, and this church actually received flood damage. All the homes in the surrounding communities, 90% of those have received flood damage. It is truly a devastated community.
And what are you able to do? What sort of help are you able to provide to the people? Have the floodwaters gone down now in the area where you are?
Yes, the floodwaters have receded, and we were able to field our first team of volunteers today that are going out into these flooded homes, helping people salvage their belongings, helping them to get packed up, and pulling carpet and sheetrock out, and then starting the cleanup process to prepare these homes so the homeowners can go about making their recovery plans in a home that's ready for rebuild.
So, and this is the situation I think Tony described when he was on the program with Ken Klukowski on Tuesday, that in his home, I think he said there was about 18 inches of water, but that's enough that the sheetrock has to be pulled out, the insulation all has to be pulled out.
Yeah,
otherwise, the house itself may not, may still stand, but basically the interior of the house has to be essentially gutted and rebuilt from the inside out. Is that essentially the situation with a lot of the homes down there?
Yes, sir. We've seen homes that have from just a couple of inches of water in them to homes that were, the water was over the eaves of the house, up
wow.
to the tops of the windows, over the doors. When water gets over about 2 feet deep in a house, it just swirls everything around. It takes the furniture and just piles it up in corners. It'll float the refrigerators and freezers and turn them over and have all of the rotten, spoiled food just dumping out.
Good grief.
And it creates quite a mess. And just a small amount, 10 to 12 inches of water can start that process. So to have these homes that had 2, 3, 4, 5 feet in them, it is the cleanup task is overwhelming.
Can I just ask you something? So one of the things is we've been sort of talking here is when you have an area that's annihilated like this, just devastated, in other words, it's not like you can go to your neighbor and get help. Everyone is in the same sort of devastated condition. So it's almost like you need help from the outside, from outside people, right, from people not in the region. And we're wondering, are there facilities or places where, I mean, I just think if it's possible, people within this radio network may be able to come and sort of drive from out of state, with tools and equipment, because there probably isn't enough tools and equipment and electric cords and things like this for people to even do work. I mean, is that accurate?
That is correct. Samaritan's Purse has partnered with Greenwell Springs Baptist Church to be able to set up a volunteer camp here at on site. For people coming from across the nation that would like to get involved, we would certainly welcome volunteers. They need to register with Samaritan's Purse prior to deploying, and they can do that at our website, samaritanspurse.org. And get all the information and register as a volunteer. We also know that there's a lot of your listeners may be aligned with a denominational relief organization. There's a lot of other organizations that are responding, and they may want to look to those avenues.
But just to reemphasize, I'm sure you would accept financial contributions on your website as well to assist with the disaster relief. Is that right?
Absolutely. There's a way to give through the Samaritan's Purse website, and we certainly welcome that. And also the prayers of your listeners. Homeowners that have been affected, for volunteers that the Lord is moving in their hearts to come, and the safety of all the workers that are involved in this cleanup phase. So the prayers, please have your folks praying for us, volunteering, and giving.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the work you're doing, and we do hope that some of the people in our listening audience are inspired to do what they can, to give what they can, money if they can, volunteer labor if they can, and certainly prayers if they're moved to do so. We thank you and affirm you for the work that you're doing down there in Louisiana, and just we will add our prayers to those of our listeners in praying that for the work that you're doing and for the recovery of all the people down there.
Thank you.
I just want to mention
Thank
to
you,
our
Todd.
Listeners, you can get, you can also find a link to where you can help at tonyperkins.com or at frc.org/flood. Tonyperkins.com or frc.org/flood.
You can make contributions.
To help with contributions. We'll be right back with Washington Watch after this break.
We'll be right back.
making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
Of course, yesterday we saw the Federal Reserve minutes come out, and we examined those and look at them. We know that the Federal Reserve is debating over interest rate increases and, of course, the timing of all of that. In the minutes of the Federal Reserve meeting, policymakers insist they need more evidence on the durability of the rebound. You know, I must admit I'm a little bit confused when I see these things. What evidence could they possibly want? You know, do you remember Ben Bernanke back, a couple years ago, indicating that interest rates will get raised as soon as we get to an unemployment rate of 7%? Now, according to the government, we are at full employment. We're at 3.9%. So what I'm trying to figure out is what more evidence do they need? Wouldn't this, by all accounts in the government, be considered full employment? And I'm trying to figure out how the economy could possibly get any better. During full employment kind of years, what happens is, of course, they raise interest rates. Why? Because they got to slow down a very heated up economy. But yet they're still looking for evidence of the durability of this economy or how well the economy is doing. Look, every time I read Fed minutes, it is nothing more than confirmation that we have been nothing but deceived and lied to from government organizations. And there is no possible way we could truly have full employment or the Fed would very quickly be raising rates.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. My name is Peter Sprigg, filling in at FRC headquarters in Washington.
And my name is Chris Gasek, and I am flying a kind of second chair here. I'm the Mr. Sulu here.
We are moving on to another story that I think has been talked about. Tony's covered before on the program, maybe a few months ago. It got a lot of attention when... I think it arose during the discussions over North Carolina's House Bill 2, which was a response to sexual orientation and gender identity ordinance passed in the city of Charlotte, and especially to this aggressive transgender agenda that's being pushed now. The North Carolina legislature responded by passing a law which, among other things, provided that restrooms and showers and locker rooms that are divided between men and women in public buildings, not in private buildings, but in public buildings within the state of North Carolina, would be separated on the basis of a person's biological sex as indicated on their birth certificate and not, as the transgender activists would want, on the basis of their self-professed gender identity. This led to a huge backlash. And among those things was the Target department store making sort of a public proclamation that anybody was welcome, basically that transgender people were welcome to use the facilities that correspond with their gender identity at Target stores, regardless of what anybody else thought about it. This led to a boycott of Target led in large part by the American Family Association. And that boycott seems to have had an effect. So we have with us now at the other end of our network here, the American Family Radio Network, Tim Wildman, the president of American Family Association and American Family Radio, to talk to us about what's going on with Target. Tim, thanks for joining us on Washington Watch.
Yeah, good to be with you.
So Target has recently discussed their latest earnings report, and what have they reported about what's happened to their business since this boycott began?
They're losing money and customers.
well, that puts it pretty concisely.
Yeah, and it can be proven. The numbers don't lie. And, you know, I was ready to accept whatever numbers came out. This boycott started in April, I think it was, after Target decided It was a great idea to announce to the world they were welcoming men into women's restrooms with little girls and the changing areas. Dudes could come in there, too, if they wanted to. As long as they, you know, thought they were a woman, they're welcome to roam around anywhere they want to go. That was Target's new policy. Well, it was Target's policy, but they decided to announce it to the world. What they were doing was trying to pile on North Carolina. You know, it was an unforced error on the part, quite frankly, of Target. They didn't have to make this announcement.
Right.
But they decided to anyway because they – and I think they thought everybody else would join them. You know, all the other big companies would join in, and right. and they looked around, and everybody went for the tall grass because because they saw a million people in 1 week. 1 week, a million people signed our boycott Target pledge. So there was a huge reaction to this decision by Target, and now they're suffering the consequences of it. And whether this can be sustained, that is the boycott, I think it can. And damage hurt their profits even more. I think that can happen because this is 1.4 million people that signed our boycott Target pledge. How many people don't sign pledges who said, you know, I'm the one heard it on the radio or saw it on social media and said, I'm not going back to that store if they're letting men in women's bathrooms. That's nuts. But they may not sign a pledge. So anyway, it's been proven now that you can have a bottom line impact on a company.
Right. And, you know, I'll point out, you mentioned 1.4 million who have signed the pledge, but the decline in sales revenue for Target was $1.3 billion.
Dollars. Over the last, compared to the last quarter.
Right. And so very dramatic. Now, Target has said that they are doing something about the bathrooms, though. They're going to create more single-user restrooms in all their stores. What do you think about that reaction?
Well, if they want to announce they're building single, like family restrooms or unisex restrooms and tell the transgender to go in there instead of going to the male or female restrooms, that'd be great. Then everybody gets a restroom. Everybody's happy. Men go to men's rooms, women go to women's rooms, and transgendered can use the unisex, have their own private bathroom. I don't know why everybody – that wouldn't make everybody happy, but I don't think that's what Target's doing this for.
Right.
I've got my tongue firmly planted in my cheek. Target's all in with the political correctness, LGBTQ movement, and so they said so. Brian Cornell, their CEO – when they made this announcement that they were welcoming men into women's restrooms with little girls, they said also, this is the right thing to do. We're on the right side of history here.
Yeah, and what I think is so astonishing about businesses, some of these businesses, is they seem to just absorb the ideology of the left and think that this is what everybody believes now, and they don't understand they have a massive customer base.
Yeah,
that
Target's a very liberal values. Target's a very liberal company historically, but anyway, they're suffering right now because this was a big loss yesterday. When all the other retailers made money, they lost.
Okay, well, Tim, thanks for joining us, giving us that update on a very very successful boycott of Target, and we'll keep in touch with you as we see what happens in the future. We'll be right back with Washington Watch after this break.
Do you enjoy history, museums, pandas, and national monuments? And are you looking to gain work experience at a Christian organization in the heart of our nation's capital? If the answer is yes, come spend a semester as an intern in Washington, D.C. with the Family Research Council. You will get a chance to experience the rich history and culture of our nation's capital and attend congressional hearings, events, rallies, and lectures all over D.C. Further, you will develop your skills in research and writing about the sanctity of life, marriage and family, religious liberty, and many other policy issues. Family Research Council's internship program includes free housing just a block away from Capitol Hill and the Supreme Court, as well as a paid stipend. As an intern, you will gain invaluable public policy experience in a professional work environment under the oversight and mentorship of FRC experts and scholars. To learn more and apply to the program, visit frc.org/internships. Again, that's frc.org/internships.
You can help plant seeds of the gospel and spread the message of the American Family Association by purchasing multiple copies of the AFA Journal, the monthly publication promoting a biblical standard of decency in American culture. Call 800-326-4543, option 2, and learn about placing copies of the journal in your church, school, office, or place of business. 800-326-4543, option 2.
The Decision America Tour with Franklin Graham.
I'm traveling to all 50 states to hold prayer rallies. We're asking Christians to vote for candidates that stand for biblical principles and biblical moral values and engage in your community by living and sharing your faith.
The Decision America Tour with Franklin Graham.
And I'm going to be sharing the gospel.
You'll find rally dates and locations, plus information on how you can be involved at DecisionAmericaTour.com.
Now is the time to take a stand.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. Control the media and you'll control the message. For decades, that has played out in the news media as the liberal establishment has indoctrinated viewers while denouncing conservative positions. But the bias doesn't stop there. Tech companies such as Facebook, Google, Apple, and Amazon are also controlled by liberal elites. Federal records show that employees at the nation's largest technology companies have given the vast majority of their political contributions to Democratic candidates. Not only do they support liberal causes, but they use their companies to restrict conservative expression. We've seen the pressure such companies have brought to bear on states that try to uphold religious liberty. And many prominent conservatives have had posts blocked by Facebook and YouTube, even after Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg assured a group of conservative leaders that changes would be made. As media and tech companies restrict conservative speech, freedom is lost. This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. Filling in for Tony today, I'm Peter Sprigg with Family Research Council in Washington.
I'm Chris Kasich.
And we're not planning on taking your calls this afternoon because we had so many guests that we wanted to talk to, especially we added Tim Wildman about that with that breaking news about the Target earnings report. And we were glad we were able to get someone from Samaritan's Purse to talk about the Louisiana flooding. During this final block, we want to talk about an interesting story that broke in the news within the last day or two. We've heard in recent weeks, about some embarrassing emails that have been released to the public as a result of hackers who have hacked into email systems. That happened right before the Democratic convention.
It's quite amazing because it seems like the Target have all been sort of left-wing groups.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now there's been similar revelations of private emails by George Soros or his organization, the left-wing billionaire. And to talk about that, we have with us Julia Seymour, who is an assistant editor and analyst for the Business and Media Institute. Julia, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure.
So tell us about some of the we're interested in this because some of these leaked emails show efforts to sort of manipulate media coverage, efforts on the part of some Soros-funded organizations to manipulate media coverage. Tell us a little bit about these organizations and what's been revealed by these emails.
Sure. Well, these leaks, I think, are going to continue to come out. According to the Fox News story I was looking at, there are more than 2,500 files just released on Saturday. So I think they're going to take some time to to dig through and really see what's all there. But they're certainly showing that he's trying to influence people from at the very top levels, including Secretary of State Hillary Clinton when she was in that role, was writing to her. But certainly, yes, he has been trying to manipulate media for many, many years. And one of the ways that we've written about how he does that is that he funds media organizations and nonprofit organizations that have media arms. And what he really accomplishes by doing that is that by giving money to all of these groups that promote his values and agenda, they've created basically an echo chamber.
And sort of in the area of social issues that we work in, I know your organization is interested in the, sort of, issue space too. Are there any, are there any revelations so far that would sort of focus in that area more?
Well, we do know that overall he's helped, the Washington Times reported this, that he helped support groups fueling the protests in Ferguson. He's been a supporter. His money has gone to support like Black Lives Matter activism.
Wow.
And things like that. The Jerusalem Post reported that he has given money to expose quote unquote Israel's racist and anti-democratic policies. And just overall, looking at where he's given money to, and not necessarily these new leaks coming out, he's pro-abortion. He's pro-environmentalist, a liberal positions on environmentalism. He's pro-LGBT, pro-Islam. He's given to all of those causes many millions of dollars.
One of the emails that was drawn to our attention because it mentioned Family Research Council was about a group called Faith in Public Life. And interesting because I think that the impression I have is that the role of this group, Faith in Public Life, is to remove faith from public life as opposed to the efforts of
no faith in
Family
public
Research
life.
Council, which is to protect the right of people to express their faith in public life. And they were bragging in this one email, bragging about the number of media hits that had been won by Faith in Public Life. And comparing it, actually, saying that they had gotten more hits than the Family Research Council, which, of course, we're not happy about that. But, groups like this, how much are they dependent on Soros, and how much do they really represent sort of grassroots supporters?
That's a good question. It really depends on the group, but he gives so much money. And many of these groups get money from other places as well. But for example, the Center for American Progress, huge left-wing organization, has gotten more than $11 million from just George Soros. People for the American Way, Norman Lear, big Hollywood lefty, his organization has gotten more than $6 million.
Wow.
Through George Soros through various channels, and they have the People for American Way has a piece of them called Right Wing Watch, which specifically exists to attack conservatives and conservative groups, and the media go to Right Wing Watch, look at those stories, and run with them.
Right. And I mean, Right Wing Watch is after Family Research Council all the time. We're very familiar with Right Wing Watch here at Family Research Council in general and on Washington Watch Radio in particular.
And General Boykin gets upset when he isn't attacked.
I think that Right Wing Watch is probably one of the most faithful listeners to the Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, actually.
Yeah.
So shout out to all of our friends there, or not so friendly acquaintances at Right Wing Watch. But
So the amount of money we're talking about here, I think I heard Dan Gaynor of your organization say something on the order of something approaching $50 million.
So what we found is that he gave $52 million to fund media organizations. That was just between 2003 and 2009. We've actually been working on updating those numbers, and they're not finalized yet. But we know that it's grown like really enormously beyond that.
So, say $52 million over about 6 years is that's a pretty good hunk of change. We're talking $8 to $10 million a year, something
it
like
is.
That, right?
Yeah.
Wow. And the members and Center for American Progress is a really big deal organization. I mean, they have Think Progress, another side organization of theirs, and PFAW, and is also has a big space in all this. So, I mean, they're really, these are like the Cadillac organizations of attacking, and PFAW is really about attacking and shutting down religious organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know if you mentioned Media Matters as another organization that I believe was involved in this.
Yeah, they've gotten more than $1 million dollars through Soros. So compared to a lot of the others, not nearly as much, but they still get his money, and they're certainly well on the left. You know, pushing the same ideas that many of these other groups are.
Just a quick question. So, because people will know in the Fox story that we have, mm-hmm. and I think I saw this web page that they're posted online, and I couldn't sort of understand how they'd still be online somewhere without having been without a legal attack from Soros or his groups. But that's a second question. So, the name of the group that leaked it is called DC Leaks.
Yeah, supposedly. I mean, I don't have any information other than this same story you're looking at.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's like out of the ether, right? It's just some kind of like, you know, black hat organization or something where, you know, Zorro comes in and puts 2,600 files on the internet somewhere. and I guess you got to grab them fast. But, I mean, this is also strange. I mean, we've never seen things like WikiLeaks, you know, going and raiding the DNC, right? And ending up, right. You know, like causing enormous turmoil. And this is, right. I mean, Soros must be absolutely stunned that lefties would be doing that. I would think there would be left-wing people.
Yeah, I can't pretend to know what
I guess
they're
not,
thinking,
right.
what Soros and the Open Society Foundations in particular are thinking, but I'm sure they're not happy.
Yeah, and I have to, I do want to say that, you know, I am bothered a little bit by the idea that our email systems are so vulnerable.
Right.
So we're certainly in reporting on this, we're not sort of celebrating the hacking of people's private emails.
Right.
But with the information out there, we feel we do have the obligation to report on some of what's being learned from this information that's been revealed. It's quite fascinating.
Peter's worried that in the future, some of his emails where it becomes clear that he roots for multiple baseball teams may become public knowledge. So, you know, it's just we're trying to, you know, just help him sort of cover his tracks on that so that he looks like a Nationals fan and a Red Sox fan.
You're right. You know, I don't think it's right to celebrate, you know, hacking. Hacking is a crime. You know, you're stealing things, you're invading privacy and all of that. And that's not okay. But as you know, once this information is out there, news organizations are going to report it. That's just the way that it is. But we actually did a story at the beginning of last month looking at a transparency report from one of Soros's own groups, a group called Transparify, a three-year-old organization that ranks think tanks from highly opaque to highly transparent. And for the third year in a row, Soros' own Open Society Foundation occupied the lowest spot in the United States.
This would be the Open Source Foundation, right? Or the Open Society Foundation, right?
That's ironic.
So, yeah, that.
Well, one question
well,
I have.
Those you know, activist liberals, they're so deeply into irony. You know, they just sort of, you know, that's sort of.
All these organizations, these media-oriented organizations, are we able to document the impact that they've had on the media? I mean, is there an obvious impact they've had? It almost seems like why would left-wing organizations need to try to influence the media, which is already dominated by the left to begin with? But do we know anything about that, about how they've impacted reporting by newspapers or networks and so forth?
That's a good question. I did not look back into all of our archives. We've been writing about George Soros for a long time and his influence. And I think I'm sure that over those years we've exposed instances where you can track back, you know, you can see the media reporting on a story from the left and you can go back and see, oh, well, this bubbled up out of this echo chamber that conveniently all gets money from Open Society Foundation or something like that. But I don't think there's a way to really quantify the overall impact of someone having this much influence in so many different organizations.
Right. But I think that the phrase you just used, the echo chamber, is a significant one because you get this narrative, the narrative that is spread, and it just the narrative is picked up sometimes without, without any critical examination.
Exactly.
And certainly I've dealt with that in some of the issues that I've been involved in. I recently wrote a piece attacking PolitiFact, for example, which is supposed to be a fact-checking organization. They had fact-checked a statement by Reince Priebus, the RNC chairman, who said that children do best with a married mom and dad or something to that effect. Fairly generic statement about the findings of social science research, but PolitiFact rated it false and cited sources that clearly were using talking points that are basically written by LGBT activists who are concerned about negative impressions regarding homosexual parents. Not that that was what the Reince Priebus or the Republican platform were specifically referring to, but nevertheless, that was sort of the framing that was put on it by that story. So that was an example of even media organizations that exists, whose reason for existing is to try to provide an objective analysis of the facts, are subject to this kind of echo chamber, as you described it.
Absolutely, and it starts even before that. I mean, Soros has also spent more than $400 million to manipulate higher education. He gives to tons of universities, including Columbia University and its School of Journalism. So the influence is starting even, as journalists are being trained before they go out and actually become journalists.
Yeah. And Columbia has the reputation of being
one of the
premier school of journalism in the country, basically, one of the top schools.
Like Missouri and Northwestern, right. They're one of the top ones. Julie, I just wanted to ask you, just to make sure we leave enough time to do it, when you write on this or other topics, where can members of the audience find your work? Are you on Twitter? And just maybe give us the sort of the full.
Well, it's very much a team effort.
Okay.
So visit our website, newsbusters.org, and you will find more about media bias than you could possibly.
So the best place, so it's newsbusters.org. Okay.
But also, you can find Newsbusters on Facebook and Twitter. And then I'm personally also on Twitter, and my handle is @BizMediaJulia.
I'm sorry, we got a thing in our ear here. At Biz Media?
Biz Media Julia.
Biz Media Julia, okay. There probably aren't too many of those. Hopefully, I would imagine there's just one of those.
Yes.
Well, I thank you for coming on and letting us pick your brain about all this, and I'm glad that we were able to sort of put this out, because as more and more people go through these files, it's going to get very, very interesting. But here, back to Peter.
All right. Yeah, thanks, Julia, for joining us on Washington Watch.
Thank you.
And we thank you for joining us, our listeners, today. Once again, we urge you to pray about helping with the Louisiana flood relief. Go to tonyperkins.com or to frc.org/flood and pray for everything that's happening down there. We'll
also
be back with you tomorrow. And
Tony will be on Megyn Kelly tonight.
That's right, on Fox News. We'll see you tomorrow.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.